This is a unique perspective on the timeline described in Daniel chapter 11 and is not affiliated with any religion or doctrine. All required research was done independently by myself and is protected by copyright unless otherwise noted. So in a previous video, we charted the ancient book of Daniel chapters 2, 7, and 8 and found that it presents a timeline from the Neo-Babylonian Empire in 605 BC until the present day and is heralding a coming asteroid impact. We also looked at Jesus' timeline in Matthew 24, which tells us the abomination of desolation that Daniel talked about will signal the start of the tribulation period that will end with the asteroid impact. So in this video, we're going to focus on the timeline in Daniel chapter 11, verses 1 through 31, which clarifies when the abomination of desolation occurred and who placed it. So in the first verse of Daniel 11, it says, "In the first year of Darius, I stood to confirm and strengthen him." So he's saying he's about to praise the king. Then in verse 2, he says, "There shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece." But notice in the original Hebrew, the word translated as yet or more, which is number 5750, can also mean continuous. So we're going to use the original Hebrew definitions a lot in this video. So if you want to verify what we're looking at here, you can go to BibleCC.com. The link is below. This right here is the lexicon view, which shows the New American Standard Bible translation in the far left column. It shows the Hebrew word that the translation corresponds to in the second and third column, the Strong's Concordance number of that Hebrew word in the fourth column, and a few of the common definitions of the word in the fifth column. So you can see we're looking at Daniel chapter 11, verse 2, up in the top left corner, and we're going to focus on the actual definitions of the Hebrew words themselves. So a more direct translation of this verse would be, "And now a conspicuous truth," which means a clear truth, "behold, three continuous kings will stand in West Asia," or three continual kings will stand in West Asia. "And the fourth will become rich with great riches from the whole force. And his riches will arouse or awaken," and that word 5782 also means incite, and incite means to cause someone to act in an angry, harmful, or violent way. So it's saying his riches will incite or cause the whole kingdom to act in a violent way toward Greece, so arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. So Darius the First was the fourth king of the Achaemenid Empire, otherwise known as the First Persian Empire. And he was the first king of that empire to invade Greece. And during his reign, he organized a new monetary system, creating 20 provinces which were required to pay tributes in gold and silver. And this new tax system that he created led to the wealth of the kingdom. So Darius the First seems to be the king described in Daniel verses 1 and 2. And then verse 3 says, "Next, a mighty king will stand up and rule with great dominion. And when he stands up, his kingdom will be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity." So that is a reference to chapter 8, verse 8, which says, "The goat waxed great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven." And that verse is explained in verse 21 of chapter 8, which clarifies that it's talking about the king of Greece, whose kingdom will be broken into four sections. And in the previous video, we found out that that refers to Alexander the Great and the Hellenistic period. So verses 3 and 4 in Daniel 11 refer to Alexander the Great and the Hellenistic period. And verses 1 through 4 span from the beginning of the Persian Empire until the start of the Hellenistic period after Alexander the Great. Then verse 5 says, "And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, he will be strong above him and have dominion, and his dominion will be a great dominion." And that appears to refer to the king of the south after Alexander's empire was split into four sections. So during the Hellenistic period. So throughout Daniel 11, the only identifying titles that were given for who the characters represent are the king of the north and the king of the south. And the first one mentioned is the king of the south right after Alexander's kingdom was split into four sections. So the first king of the north and king of the south in Daniel 11 refer to the Seleucid Empire in the Syrian region and the Ptolemaic kingdom in Egypt. So the Seleucid kingdom in yellow here was to the north of Jerusalem, and the kingdom to the south of Jerusalem was the Egyptian Ptolemaic dynasty, and that was founded by Ptolemy the First. So the king of the south in verse 5 and one of his princes appears to refer to Ptolemy the First and Second, who were the first two kings of the Ptolemaic kingdom of the south after Alexander's death. And you can see that Ptolemy the First's son, Ptolemy the Second, ruled twice as long as his father. And it says here, during Ptolemy the Second's reign, the splendor of the Alexandrian court was at its height. So the king of the south mentioned in verse 5 and one of his princes was Ptolemy the First and Ptolemy the Second. But then notice in verse 6, it says it will take place in the end of years. So it's referring to something in the future after years have gone by. So in order to find that event, we look for a pattern between the first section and the second section, verses 1 through 4, which refer to Darius and Alexander the Great. And it turns out there were exactly 10 kings between Darius the First and Alexander the Great. So Darius the Second was the fifth king after Darius the First, and Artaxerxes was the 10th. Right before Alexander. So there were exactly 10 kings between Darius the First and Alexander the Great. So Ptolemy in verse 5 ruled right after Alexander. So to find the next section that starts in verse 6, which says it takes place in the end of years, we can count 10 kings from where verse 5 left off. So 10 kings after Ptolemy the First and Second. So when we count 10 kings starting on Ptolemy the First or Ptolemy the Second, the 10th king lands on Cleopatra the Third or Cleopatra Selene. So it says in verse 6, "And in the end of years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of the arm. Neither shall he stand for his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times." So the first point is the king's daughter of the south will come to the king of the north to make an agreement. And it says here, Cleopatra the Third established an alliance with one of the warring Syrian kings, Antiochus the Eighth, giving him Cleopatra Selene as his wife. So she's giving her daughter to the Syrian king of the north. So Antiochus the Eighth was the king of the Seleucid Empire here in yellow, which was to the north of Jerusalem. And the queen of the south, Cleopatra the Third, gave her daughter Cleopatra Selene to the king of the north in marriage. So the most simple, direct translation of the original Hebrew words in this verse would be, "In the end, of the years they will be joined, the daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an arrangement to retain strength. But she will not gain power by taking a stand with arms. So in foreign language, the negative adverb right there sometimes comes after the intended subject. So it's saying she will not gain power by taking a stand with arms. And the word translated as arms, which is number 2220, means political and military forces. So it's saying she will not gain power by taking a stand with military forces, but give or be set to go in to bear, bring forth, or beget, which means have children and strengthen over time. So verse 6 of Daniel 11 describes Cleopatra III sending her daughter Cleopatra Selene to marry the king of the north. And this occurs toward the end of the Hellenistic period. And that's probably why it says it will occur in the end of years. And then the King James translation of verse 7 says, "But out of a branch of her roots shall stand up one in his estate, which shall come with an army and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north and shall deal against them and prevail." But when we look at the Hebrew words alone, we can see that the simplest translation of verse 7 would read, "A sprout of her root," or one of the descendants of her line, "will stand on a pedestal and go in to strength or wealth, go in to a place of protection, and the king of the north will make him or her strong." So this tells us the next section of Daniel will be about one of Cleopatra III's descendants. And since the first three sections of Daniel 11 were separated by 10 kings, we can count 10 kings forward from verse 6 to see if the next ruler is a match. So it tells us we're looking at the descendants of the south, and verse 6 left off at Cleopatra III. So when we start with her, Arsinoe IV is the ninth ruler, and he is also down at the bottom of the family tree diagram. He's the ninth, and Cleopatra the Selene is the next descended on the 10th line. So you can see the line of descent from Cleopatra III here, and Cleopatra Selene II would be the 10th after Arsinoe. And you can see here she was the only daughter of Cleopatra VII and Mark Antony. And this was occurring at the end of the Hellenistic period and the beginning of the Roman Empire. So it says her parents committed suicide as Octavian and his army invaded Egypt. Octavian captured Cleopatra and her brothers and took them from Egypt to Italy and gave them to Octavian Minor to be raised up in her household in Rome. So Selene was raised in the household of the Roman emperor, in other words, the place of wealth and protection, just as it says right here. One of the descendants of her line will stand on a pedestal and go into wealth, go into a place of protection, and the king of the north will make her strong. So that's what happened. And then the Emperor Augustus arranged for her to marry King Juba II. And as a wedding present, she was given a huge dowry and she became an ally to Rome. She was the only surviving member of the Ptolemaic dynasty. So in other words, the only surviving member of the King of the South. And then King Juba and Cleopatra Selene II were sent to Mauritania and the kingdom flourished, it says. So Mauritania is in northwestern Africa, where modern-day Morocco is located, right here, in dark red right there. And this is where Cleopatra Selene II was sent by the Roman emperor to Rome, to rule for Rome. So verses 6 and 7 say, in the end of years, which was the end of the Ptolemaic kingdom of Egypt, the daughter Cleopatra Selene of the king of the south, which is Cleopatra III, will go to the king of the north to make an arrangement to retain strength, but she will not gain power by taking a stand with military forces, but be set to go in to bring forth children and strengthen over time. Then one of the descendants of her line will stand on a pedestal and go into wealth, go into a place of protection, and the king of the north will make her strong. And that was Cleopatra Selene II, who was raised in the Roman emperor's household. Then verse 8 says, in the translation directly from the Hebrew words, it says, also the gods and molten images that are desired and vessels of silver and gold will go from captivity to their country in northwestern Africa. So notice that word was translated as Egypt, but the definition says it refers to northwestern Africa, which is actually where Mauritania was. So it says she will go from captivity to northwestern Africa, and she will stand with the king of the north for years. So Cleopatra Selene II was first held in captivity in Rome after her parents' death when Rome invaded Egypt, and she was raised by the Roman emperor's household and married to King Juba II, and they were sent to rule over Mauritania in northwestern Africa. So that seems to be a fulfillment of verses 7 and 8. And then verse 9 says, so she will go in to royal power. The king of the south will return to his own land, or to her own land, as this case would be. So remember in Daniel 7, it established for us that the word king can also refer to a whole kingdom. So Cleopatra Selene II, because she was a sole survivor of the Ptolemaic kingdom of the south, represented the whole Ptolemaic kingdom when she returned to Africa and became queen of Mauritania with King Juba. So she returned to her own land, Africa. And it's also interesting, verse 8 mentions that she and King Juba brought the gods of Rome into Africa, because it says here under their son Ptolemy of Mauritania that Saturn became a prominent god in Mauritania during his reign, and his cult became an important one in the kingdom. So the cult of Saturn, I guess, became really important. That was Roman religion. So it says a temple and a sanctuary were dedicated to Saturn by the year 30 CE. And throughout Mauritania, various temples were dedicated to Saturn. So Saturn was the god that they brought from Rome. And that makes sense, because the temple of Saturn was originally in Rome and was rebuilt in the year 42 BC. So Daniel 11, verses 7 through 9, seem to describe Cleopatra the Selene II going into captivity in Rome, but coming into wealth and power and being sent back to her own land in Africa and ruling with the Roman Empire, which at this point has become the king of the north. So she's standing with the king of the north at this point. And it says here, Mauritania became a client of the Roman Empire in 33 BC and a full province after the death of Selene's son Ptolemy in 40 AD. So the king of the north, which was the Seleucid Empire during the Hellenistic period, has now become the Roman Empire. The green section was Selene's father's kingdom, Mark Antony, and the reddish section in Egypt was formerly her mother's kingdom, Cleopatra, but both of them died when Augustus invaded, and she was sent to Rome, Italy, and raised there. And now at this point in the story, she is married and living in Mauritania as the only surviving member of the former Ptolemaic kingdom. So this also seems to clarify that the land of the king of the south is Africa at this point, not just Egypt. And the king of the north at this point is the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire looked like this just one generation later, surrounding the entire Mediterranean Sea. So this is the king of the north at this point, the Roman Empire. And verses 7 through 9 also seem to refer to the start of the Western Roman Empire. Then verse 10 says in the King James translation, "But his son shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up to his fortress." So the direct translation would say the sons, or 11:21, which means descendants. The descendants, or her descendants, because it's talking about Selene, her descendants will stir up and gather abundance and great strength and wealth, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through and return to stir up strife up to his very fortress. So verse 10 refers to the descendants of the king of the south, and verse 9, the descendants of Cleopatra Selene II and King Juba II of Mauritania. So Cleopatra Selene and King Juba, they had a son. They named him Ptolemy, and he became known as Ptolemy of Mauritania. And he married Julia Urania, and they had a daughter named Drusilla, who became known as Drusilla of Mauritania the Younger. And Drusilla had a son named Gaius Julius Alexio, who became a Syrian prince and Roman client priest king of Emesa. And he had a son called Gaius Julius Fabia Sampsiceramus III Silas, who was also a Syrian prince and Roman client priest king of Emesa. And a descendant of his was Gaius Julius Bassianus, who was a Syrian high priest for the Temple of the Sun. And take note of this because it'll show up later. The Temple of the Sun was adorned in the shape of a black stone. And this is in the 3rd century when Emesa was a client kingdom of the Roman Empire. And his daughter married the Roman Emperor Lucius Septimus Severus, and one of their sons was Lucius Septimus Bassianus, who was also known as Caracalla. And he reigned as Roman Emperor from 198 CE until 211 CE. So the descendants of the King of the South moved from here in Egypt to Rome, then to Mauritania, and then to Syria. And now the descendant of the King of the South is ruling as emperor in the north. So verse 10 says, "Her descendants will stir up and gather abundance and great strength and wealth, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through and return to stir up strife up to his very own fortress." And Caracalla, who was the king of the north, who was the descendant of the king of the south, in 215 savagely slaughtered over 20,000 people in Alexandria, which was in Egypt, his ancestral home. So he stirred up strife up to his very own fortress. He attacked his ancient homeland. And also there were exactly 20 kings between the reign of Augustus and Cleopatra Selene until Caracalla. So Claudius was the 3rd king after Augustus. Then Otto was the 6th. Domitian was the 10th. Hadrian was the 13th. Commodus was the 17th. And Septimius Severus was the 20th. who was the father of Caracalla. So exactly 20 kings between Augustus and Caracalla. So since there were exactly 20 Roman kings between verse 9 and verse 10, then we might find the fulfillment of verse 11 if we count 20 kings from Caracalla. So Elagabalus was the third king from Caracalla. Then Gordian would be the sixth. Balbinus would be the ninth. Trajan Decius would be the 12th. Aemilian would be the 15th. The 18th would be Claudius Gothicus. And the 20th from Caracalla was Aurelian, who was Roman emperor from 270 until 275 CE. And during his reign in 272, he fought against Queen Zenobia, who had carved out her own empire encompassing Syria, Palestine, Egypt, and large parts of Asia Minor. This is a map of her empire right here in yellow. It was called the Palmyrene Empire. And it says here, Zenobia was a third century queen who led a famous revolt against the Roman Empire, but she was defeated by the Roman Emperor Aurelian. And she was also a descendant from Cleopatra as well. It says her father's paternal ancestry included the royal family of Emesa, which means she was also a descendant of Caracalla. But unlike Caracalla, who attacked his ancient homeland, she apparently knew her ancestry and attempted to win back the whole region, but she was defeated by the Roman emperor in 272. And the Palmyrene Empire at that point was taken back again by Rome. So Daniel 11 verses 11 and 12 seem to refer to Zenobia's Palmyrene Empire and Aurelian's capture of it. The King James translation says, "The king of the south shall be moved with choler and shall come forth and fight with the king of the north." So that would be Zenobia revolting against the Roman Empire. "And he," meaning the king of the south, Zenobia, "will set forth a great multitude, but the multitude will be given into his hand," meaning Zenobia's empire will be given into the hand of the king of the north, Aurelian. And then it says, "When he takes away the multitude," meaning Aurelian, "his heart will be lifted up and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it." But notice in verse 12, the word "not" isn't there. So the translation straight from Hebrew says, "When the abundance or multitude is taken, his heart will be exalted and 10,000 will fall and he will be strong." So the negative that they put in the translation here seems to be wrong. I don't see any negative in the Hebrew here. So it seems to be saying he takes the empire and feels strong afterward. So Daniel verse 11 and 12 take place around 270 CE when Zenobia, the descendant of the south, revolted against the Roman Empire, which was the king of the north at this point. But she was defeated by the Roman Emperor Aurelian. And that event occurred 20 kings after the last event in Daniel. And when we count 10 kings from Aurelian, we come to the next event. So if we count Aurelian as the first, Carus would be the fifth. Then Diocletian would be the eighth. And the tenth would be Constantius Chlorus, who was the father of Constantine the Great and the founder of the Constantinian dynasty. And this is the time period when the Roman Empire became a Christian empire. So verse 13 says, "The king of the north," that's still the Roman Empire, "will return and set forth a multitude greater than the former and come after certain years with a great army and much riches." So the Constantinian dynasty began as the Eastern Roman Empire, otherwise known as the Byzantine Empire, was rising to power. And that was the second phase of the Roman Empire coming into existence. So the Roman Empire that Augustus founded was dying off at this point, but a new phase was rising with the Constantinian dynasty that changed the religion of the empire from pagan polytheistic, the belief in many gods, to monotheistic Christian, the belief in only one God. So verse 13, the king of the north, the Roman Empire, will return and set forth a multitude greater than the former. So the Eastern Roman Empire is coming into existence. And in those times, it says, many will stand up against the king of the south. Also, the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. So that's interesting because Constantine the Great is the one who claimed that he saw a vision in the sky that told him to use the Christian cross as a symbol of war. And that was the beginning of the Christian Roman Empire. So that seems to be the fulfillment of verse 14. They exalt themselves at that point, starting with the vision of Constantine, as if to say they were sent from God. So verses 13 and 14 occur at the founding of the Constantinian dynasty, which was the rise of the Christian Roman Empire. And then if we count 20 kings from Constantius Chlorus, Constantine the Great would be the third. Licinius would be the sixth. Then Constans would be the ninth. The 13th would be Valentinian the first. The 16th would be Valentinian the second. The 19th was Honorius. And the 20th was Theodosius the second, who reigned from 402 until 450. And during his reign, there was a large-scale invasion by Attila the Hun coming from the far north. So the Roman Empire was still ruling north of Jerusalem at that time. But the invasion of Attila the Hun came from even further north. So at this point, the king of the north has changed. It's now referring to the northern tribes who were pushing south at that time. And this time period is also known as the migration period. The Goths and the Vandals were the first tribes coming from the north to move into the Roman Empire. And then the Visigoths invaded Italy and sacked Rome in 410, and they were followed by the Ostrogoths, who settled in Italy. So this is a map right here of the migration period, showing the Goths in red up at the top, the Vandals in blue just below that, the Visigoths and Ostrogoths in purple and pink settling in Italy, and the Huns are in green here. So Attila's rule of the Huns started around 434 or 437, according to this, when he reigned with Bleda. And then when he reigned alone, he was the seventh of a total of 10 Hunnic rulers. So there were 10 kings there. And it says here the Huns were a group of Eurasian nomads that some scholars believe originated in northern China. They moved past Germany without a problem. And at the same time the Huns were moving into the Roman Empire from the north, the Vandals were circling around and coming at Rome from the south. So the Roman Empire was being surrounded by the northern tribes at this point. And it says in 447, Attila entered the Eastern Roman Empire through Moesia. And in 450, the sister of Roman Emperor Valentinian sent her engagement ring to Attila with a plea for help. Attila interpreted it as a marriage proposal. And in 452, he invaded Italy on his way to claim his marriage to Honoria. And it says he planned to invade the capital of the Roman Empire at Constantinople, but he died in 453, and it, according to at least three ancient records, he was killed by his wife. So the direct translation of verse 17 says, he will set his face to go in to the strength of the whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal which he plans to put into effect to give or set the daughter as his wife. So that was Honoria, who was the daughter of Roman Emperor Constantius III. And then it says, perhaps to go to ruin to take one's stand. But the word 7843, which was translated as ruin, it also means corrupt. So it seems to be saying to set the daughter as his wife to corrupt the empire and take and make his stand. So verses 15 through 17 seem to refer to the migration period when the Roman Empire was invaded by the tribes coming from the north. And verse 17 specifically seems to refer to Attila the Hun's invasion between 434 and 453 and his intent to marry Honoria, who was the daughter of Constantius III, which was the emperor of the Western Roman Empire. At the same time, Theodosius II was ruling the Eastern Roman Empire. So these events occurred 20 kings after the previous section, and 20 kings forward, we find the fulfillment of the next section. So from Theodosius II, Valentinian III would be the fourth. Avidus would be the seventh. The 12th would be Glycerius. The 14th would be Romulus. The 15th would be Leo. The 18th would be Basilicus. And the 20th was Justin the First before Justin the Great. So there were exactly 20 kings between Theodosius II when Attila the Hun invaded and Justinian the Great. So this next section, starting in verse 18, should occur during Justinian's reign, which was from 527 until 565. And that is when the Vandalic War occurred. So verse 18 says, and this is the American Standard Translation, then he will turn his face to the coastlands, or that was also translated as islands in the King James. He will turn his face to the islands and capture many, but a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. So the Vandals in blue on this map had also come from the north, but while the Romans were fighting against the Huns, the Vandals had moved around the empire and were now attacking Rome from the south. So it says here, the Vandal navy carried out pirate attacks throughout the Mediterranean, sacked Rome, and defeated a Roman invasion in 468, and in 530, Gelimer became king of the Vandals. And it says his elaborate plan to encircle and destroy the Roman army came close to a success, but Justinian's general Belisarius was able to drive the Vandals out. So the commander in verse 18 seems to refer to Belisarius. And then it says, the Vandal king Gelimer fled to a remote mountain and surrendered in the spring. And that matches verse 19, which says, then shall he turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. However, it says, after Gelimer surrendered, the Moorish tribes of the interior of Africa rose up in rebellion, and the Roman general John Traglita in 548 ended the Moorish revolt, but he died 4 years later in 552, and it says the exact date of his death is unknown, so it seems he did not die in a battle. So the American Standard translation of verse 20 says, "Then in his place one will arise who will send an oppressor." But the word 3653, which you can see means base, pedestal, or office, that also means place. In other words, in that location in northern Africa where the Vandalic War was occurring. It says, in that place one will arise who will pass through and oppress through the splendor of the kingdom. Yet within a few days he will be shattered, though not in anger or in battle. So again, the Roman general John Traglita was the one who put a stop to the Moorish revolt in 548, and he died just a few years later in 552, but not in battle. So we also know that days can also represent years in the biblical text. So when it says in verse 20, within a few days he'll be shattered, it can also mean within a few years he'll be shattered, and that's what happened. So verses 18 through 20 seem to refer to first the Vandalic War, when the Vandals captured the islands, but that was stopped by the commander General Belisarius, and the Vandal King Gelimer then fled back to his land, but then surrendered. And in that land, in that location in northern Africa, the Moorish tribes revolted, and the Roman general John Traglita suppressed their revolt, but then died a few years later of what seems to be natural causes. He didn't die in battle. And all of this occurred in Justinian the I's reign. And I just wanted to point out that the King James translation of verse 20, which says, "Then shall stand up a raiser of taxes," that word right there corresponds to this word, number 5065, which means oppress. And the definition oppress is actually used more often in the Bible. The only time, in fact, this word was ever translated as taxes was apparently here in this verse right here. So it doesn't apply to this fulfillment. The word in verse 20 means oppressor. It's not talking about taxes. And then verse 21, the direct translation says, "And in the office," or in that place, "a despised person will stand in the majesty of the kingdom, set to go in quietly and grow strong with royal power, with smoothness," or seize the kingdom by intrigue. And the King James translation in verse 21 says, "obtain the kingdom by flatteries." So Justinian the Great was the Roman emperor from 527 until 565. But it says here he was born into a peasant family and adopted by his uncle Justin, who later became emperor. Then it says Justinian was made associate emperor, then consul, then commander, and then after Justin's death, Justinian became emperor. And it says he achieved lasting fame by his complete revision of Roman law, which is also known as the Justinian Code. And that may be partially what verse 22 alludes to when it says the Prince of the Covenant, but there's more to that, which we'll go into in a minute. But it says one of the most spectacular features of Justinian's reign was the recovery of large stretches of land around the Western Mediterranean, which had slipped out of imperial control in the 5th century. And it says Justinian considered it his divine duty to restore the Roman Empire to its ancient boundaries. And it says he defeated the Vandals and reconquered northern Africa in 533 and 534. Then from 552 to 554, he defeated the Ostrogoths within a month. He defeated the Franks, restored Italy, and established the province of Spania. So verse 22 direct translation says any flood of forces will overflow from or before him and break into pieces. Also, the Prince of the Covenant. Or it can also read, moreover, he was the Prince of the Covenant. So it's not clear if Justinian himself is the Prince of the Covenant or someone else, but it does make clear that the covenant starts in verse 22, which appears to be during the reign of Justinian. And on the surface, that covenant may have something to do with the peace treaties that Justinian signed with the neighboring Persian Empire, which was known then as the Sassanid Empire. And you can see on this map where the boundaries were from 387 to 591. So the wars between the Roman Empire and the Persian Empire began around 92 BC and lasted for 7 centuries. And the only thing that finally ended these conflicts was the rise of the Muslim Empire. And that originated with the birth of Muhammad, just 5 years after Justinian's reign ended. So the conflicts between the Romans and the Persians had been going on for centuries. And during Justinian's reign, there were several peace treaties that were signed and broken. The first peace treaty was called the Eternal Peace Treaty that apparently the Persian king broke in 540. And a new one was signed in 545, then another one in 557, and then another one again in 562. So verses 21 and 22 seem to refer to Justinian the Great, and verse 22 mentions the Prince of the Covenant, and that could have referred to either Justinian or the Persian king during the peace treaties. However, the next section that we're going to look at seems to imply that the covenant was something much deeper than a military peace treaty. So verse 23 says, and after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. So we know that refers to the king of the north, because it has been talking about the king of the north since verse 15. It says the king of the north comes and takes the cities. So at this point, the king of the north was the northern tribes, the Vandals, the Goths, and the Huns. And so they were the king of the north in verses 15 through 17. But then Attila the Hun died and they backed off. And then in verses 18 through 20, the Vandals were conquered by the Romans. And even though the Vandals had originally come from the north, by this time they were attacking Rome from the south. So the Vandals in the north became the king of the south at that point. And the Roman Empire won that battle and recovered the land. So at that point, the Roman Empire again became the king of the north. So by verse 20, the Roman Empire has restored its control as the king of the north. And verses 21 and 22 refer to Justinian, who started out as a peasant. But after he became king, he restored much of the land that was lost to the northern tribes earlier. So now it mentions the covenant in verse 22. So we know it's a covenant that the king of the north makes, which was the Roman Empire at this point. So the covenant, like I said before, may refer to the peace treaties between the Roman Empire and the neighboring Sassanid Empire. But those peace treaties did not actually end the centuries of conflicts between these two empires. They continually were breaking those treaties and making new ones. The only thing that ended the conflicts was the rise of the Muslim Empire. But the Sassanid Empire, the Persian Empire, it was not Muslim at this point. They were what the Christians would call pagan. So the Roman Empire at this point was Christian, and they were demanding that their citizens convert to Christianity. That was in the Code of Justinian. So at this point, Justinian has made it law that you have to be Christian in order to be a citizen. It says here, that the Code of Justinian served to secure the status of Christianity as the state religion of the empire, uniting church and state and making anyone who was not connected to the Christian church a non-citizen. And the very first law in the Codex requires all persons under the jurisdiction of the empire to hold the Christian faith. And then it says other laws forbid particular pagan practices. So the Persians next door were pagan. So Justinian was attempting to convert them, to conquer the territory and convert their religion. Because remember, he said he believed it was his divine duty to conquer the lands around him. So Daniel indicates here that the Prince of the Covenant was connected to Justinian somehow. Either it was Justinian himself or the Persian king or someone else. So one of the things that were going on at that time was the peace treaties between Justinian and the Persian king, but they were unsuccessful. So it seems more likely that the covenant refers to something else. And we're given another clue about this covenant in verse 28. It says it's a holy covenant. So it's not just a military peace treaty. This may indicate that it's a religious treaty. But the league, though, in verse 23, where it says after the league made with him, that league is not the same thing as the holy covenant in verse 28. And also in verse 22, it's not the same thing. It's something different. This right here is verse 23, and you can see the word that was translated as league or alliance. The number of that word is 2266. But in verse 28, the words holy covenant correspond to the words numbers 6944 and 1285. So the holy covenant and the league or alliance are not necessarily the same thing. They could be different things. But the word covenant here in verse 28, number 1285, is the same word used in verse 22, the Prince of the Covenant. So this covenant right here that starts in verse 22 during Justinian's reign refers to the Holy Covenant in verse 28, but not necessarily the League in verse 23. So the League that is made during Justinian's reign probably refers to the peace treaties between these two empires that were occurring during that time. So verse 23 says, after one of those treaties, the king of the north will work deceitfully. And that makes sense because the treaties were failing. They kept breaking them and making new ones every few years. So it makes sense that they would devise a different plan at that point. So it seems to tell us that the deceit started in Justinian's reign, and it has to do with a holy covenant. In other words, a religious covenant. So remember, Justinian gave governmental power to the popes during his time. He united church and state. So the Prince of the Covenant may refer to one of the religious leaders. So let's just take a look at the popes during that time period. So Justinian ruled from 527 until 565. And there were several popes during his reign, starting with Felix IV through John III. And John III was the one that caught my attention. He reigned from 561 until 574. And that was in the last few years of Justinian's reign, and he continued as pope into the reign of Justin II. And that is also around the time that Muhammad was born in 570. So just keep in mind that Muhammad was the one that ended the 7 centuries of Roman-Persian wars. Okay, so it says here that during the reign of Justin II, after Justinian, Pope John III retired and took up residence at the catacombs along the Via Appia outside of the city. So the Via Appia is Appian Way. It was the earliest and most important Roman road completed in 312 BC. So this is Appian Way right here. You can see it starts in Rome and ends at the southeastern coast of Italy. So it says Pope John went into the catacombs along this road, and catacombs are underground passageways for religious practice, most commonly associated with the Roman Empire. It says they're used for war refugees, smugglers' hideouts, or meeting places. And the first place to be referred to as catacombs was the system of underground tombs between the second and third milestones of the Appian Way in Rome. So after the death of Justinian, during the reign of his successor, Justin II, Pope John III retired into the underground tunnels along this path that ends at the seaport in southeastern Italy. Okay, so just bear with me for a second. I'm going to speculate here a little bit, but if Pope John III was the Prince of the Covenant in verse 22, because remember, this covenant is a holy covenant, so it's a religious covenant. So if Pope John III was the Prince of the Holy Covenant in verse 22 during Justinian's reign, and is the one who works deceitfully after Justinian's peace treaties in verse 23, then his retirement into the underground tunnels of Appian Way could have been a private mission to Syria. He could have gone underground and came out unnoticed and traveled the road incognito to the port in southeastern Italy and then traveled by boat to Syria. And I mean, this is just speculation, but it does make sense because we're about to find out that Muhammad was taught by a Christian monk in Syria. So just bear with me for a second. It says Pope John III died in 574, but it seems there's a 6-year period between 568 and 574. It says he retired underground sometime in or after 568. So it seems to imply that he was underground for 6 years. So was he really underground for 6 years, or did he just leave the country? It makes sense to me that he just privately left and went on a mission to Syria, maybe. So the other interesting thing about this time period is that Justin II, who took the throne after Justinian, ended up going insane. It says he was trying to deal with a conflict with the Persians and he stopped paying them, basically, because which caused the situation to escalate, because Justinian was paying them. Justinian was paying a lot of countries in order to subdue them. So there had to be a new plan. I mean, things could not continue as they were. Something had to change. Nothing was working. So Justin II stopped paying the Persians, and that started another war. Just like these two empires have been going to war for centuries. But it says after two disastrous campaigns in which the Persians overran Syria and captured the fortress of Dara, Justin reportedly lost his mind. Then it says down at the bottom, the temporary fits of insanity into which Justin fell warned him to name a colleague, and he raised the general Tiberius to be Caesar in 574. And withdrew into retirement. So it was something involving Syria that caused Justin II to lose his mind. So just keep in mind that Muhammad's new religion of Islam is what finally ended the conflicts between the Romans and the Persians. And the border of those conflicts was in Syria, right here. So it was the events in Syria that caused Justin II to go insane. And Syria is where Muhammad met the Christian monk who many say influenced the creation of Islam. And Islam is what ultimately ended the Roman-Persian wars. Okay, so this event in verse 23, it's talking about deceit. It's saying the king of the north works deceitfully at this point. Okay, so let's just look at the life of Muhammad, and all of this will start making sense. It says Muhammad was born in 570 and was orphaned at an early age and raised under the care of his uncle. At age 40, he reported that he was visited by the angel Gabriel, which is also the Christian name of the angel, by the way. And 3 years later, he started preaching that God is one and that complete surrender to him is the only way. It says Muhammad gained few followers early on and was met with hostility because the Persians were polytheistic. They did not believe in one God. They believed in many gods. So it says he started with a few followers, but eventually gathered an army of 10,000 Muslim converts and took over the city of Mecca with little bloodshed. He destroyed the pagan idols and destroyed all the remaining pagan temples. So he was doing the same thing the Roman Empire was doing at that same time, eradicating paganism. Because this is right after Justinian outlawed pagan practices. So it sounds to me like Justinian would have liked Muhammad. Then it says, eventually he united Arabia into a single Muslim religious polity. So it tells us here, in pre-Islamic Arabia, gods or goddesses were viewed as protectors of individual tribes. So that was their religion. It was a form of paganism. It says their shrine called the Kaaba was housed with 360 idol statues of tribal patron deities. So this is before Muhammad. And it says there were a few monotheistic communities in Arabia, like Christians and Jews and Hanifs. And Muhammad was a Hanif. So this goes into more depth about his childhood. It says his father died 6 months before he was born, and he was sent to live with a foster family in the desert until he was six. That's one story, but then other scholars say that's not true. His mother died when he was six. But either way, he was orphaned at the age of six and went to live with his grandfather. And then after his grandfather died, he went to live with his uncle. And his uncle was a merchant, and Muhammad would go on trading journeys to Syria with him. And it says on one of those journeys, he met a Christian monk named Bahira, who is said to have foreseen Muhammad's career as a prophet of God. So Bahira is also known as Sergius the Monk. And it says here, when Muhammad was either 9 or 12 years old, he met Bahira in the town of Basra in Syria. So this is modern day Basra here. So Muhammad regularly traveled with his uncle from Mecca to Basra for trade. And when he was between 9 and 12 years old, he met a Christian monk there who, according to legend, foresaw his life as a prophet of God. But it says the monk, I guess this is the legend right here. It says the monk invited the merchants to a feast and they accepted, leaving Muhammad to guard the camel. But the monk insisted that Muhammad come to him and then proceeded to warn them to keep the child away from the Jews and the Christians. The interesting thing is both of these Persian authors here wrote that the Christians corrupted their gospels by erasing the references to Muhammad. So according to them, someone on the Roman side did not want a record of Muhammad's meeting with the Christian monk for some reason. And then it says the Apocalypse of Bahira makes the case for an origin of the Quran from Christian apocrypha. Arabist authors maintain that Bahira's works formed the basis of those parts of the Quran that conform to the principles of Christianity. In other words, it's saying here that Arabian authors believe Christian writings influence the creation of the Muslim holy book. And it says down at the bottom, the early Christian biographies of Muhammad often identified Bahira, or Sergius the Monk, as a secret religious teacher to Muhammad. So then Muhammad's story goes on. It says during one of his visits to Mount Hira, the angel Gabriel appeared to him and he was deeply distressed by it and was consoled by his wife and her Christian cousin. Okay, so his wife, by the way, proposed to him. It says here in 595, a 40-year-old widow proposed marriage to him and he accepted, and her name was Khadijah. And her cousin was Christian. So it says, when he was in the mountains, the angel Gabriel appeared to him and he was deeply distressed by it. And the wife that chose him, along with her Christian cousin, made him feel better about that. And then it says, one of the main roles of Muhammad is to warn the unbelievers of their eschatological punishment. It says Muhammad's mission also involves preaching monotheism and God's final judgment, followed by vivid descriptions of the tortures of hell and pleasures in paradise. So that sounds a lot like Christianity as well. And then it says around 613, Muhammad began to preach to the public with only a few followers. So verse 23 says, he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. So the king of the north, it says, is working deceitfully. The Roman Empire is working deceitfully. So let's just take it. Let's just take a look at the direct translation right there of verse 23. The direct translation is, after the alliance, make deceit and ascend. So notice it does not say, it doesn't specify the king of the north will ascend or rise up. It says, after the alliance is made, someone, it doesn't specify who, someone will practice deception and someone will ascend or rise up and become vast or mighty with only a few people. And this is right after Justinian. And it seems to imply that it's the prince of the covenant who is working deceitfully. So verse 23 seems to be saying that after one of those failing peace treaties between the Romans and the Persians, the prince of the covenant in the Roman Empire will work deceitfully and someone will rise up and become strong with only a few people. And this person who rises up will enter peaceably, it says, even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his father's fathers. So it's saying, the king of the north, the Roman Empire, will raise up someone who will start with a small number of people and enter peaceably and do something that his ancestors didn't do. So that fits Muhammad. So in 613, it says when he started preaching, only a few became his followers, and then the opposition started when Muhammad delivered verses that condemned idol worship and the forefathers who engaged in polytheism. So he was teaching something that opposed what his ancestors taught. And then it says Muhammad's denunciation of the Meccan traditional religion was especially offensive to his own tribe, as they were the guardians of the Kaaba. So the Kaaba, by the way, was the Arabian temple. It was much older than the Muslim religion. It says right here, the Kaaba was the focal point of Meccan religious life that Muhammad threatened to overthrow. So Muhammad was teaching something that was contrary to what his forefathers believed. And that's verse 24. So there's still no war at this point. So this ideology is entering peacefully. But the Persians in Mecca were resistant to this monotheistic ideology. And in 615, some of his followers moved to the Ethiopian Empire and founded a small colony under the protection of the Christian emperor. So the early Muslims, it said, sought refuge among the Christians. And then some of them returned after high-ranking people in Mecca converted to Islam. And then in 622, it says Muhammad moved to Medina and was appointed the chief arbitrator of that community. So Medina, by the way, is right here between Mecca and Syria. And it says the people of Medina at that point began to convert to Islam. But then problems broke out in Mecca, and it says the Muslims initiated armed conflict to work toward the goal of conquering Mecca. And in 624, Muhammad led 300 warriors in a raid on a Meccan caravan, and they won, killing 45 Meccans. So he started out peaceful, but now he's killing people for not converting to the monotheistic religion. So after the killing started, many of the tribes converted to Islam without opposition. And it says Muhammad expelled a couple of the main Jewish tribes in Medina and took their property, and then prepared an army of 3,000 and adopted a form of defense that was unknown in Persia at that time. So new unusual war tactics, as well as this new unusual religion. And then it says they beheaded people who would not convert to Islam. And the Syrian trade with Mecca vanished at that point. So remember, he met the Christian monk in Syria who Arabian writers said taught Muhammad. So Mecca refused to convert to the new religion Muhammad was proposing, and then suddenly they found themselves without trade to Syria. So it sounds like Muhammad was blocking their trade route through Medina to Syria. And then it says he started leading wars and conquests. In 630, he marched on Mecca with 10,000 Muslim converts, and most of the people converted to Islam. And then it says he destroyed the statues of Arabian gods, but personally spared the paintings of Mary and Jesus. And then it talks about his conquest of Arabia and his destruction of their pagan idols. And then within a decade, it says Muhammad's new religion conquered Mesopotamia, Byzantine Syria, Byzantine Egypt, large parts of Persia, and established the Rashidun Caliphate, which was the Muslim empire. So this is one of the maps of his conquests right here. So verse 25 says, "And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him." And then verse 26 says, "They that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain." Okay, but notice the word in verse 26 that was translated as "feed" in the King James. It also means eat. So it's saying they that eat a portion of his food will destroy his strength and overflow. So it's saying the king of the south will be destroyed by one of his own, basically. They that eat the king of the south's food will destroy him. Their army will overflow. So it's talking about the conquest of Arabia right here. And this is also interesting. It says here that Muhammad had a white face. It was so white, it shone like the moon, which seems sort of odd to me for somebody who grew up in the Arabian desert in the 6th century. I don't know, but it just seemed kind of odd. Also, the Muslim religion requires their members to make a statement that Muhammad is a messenger of God, which is very similar to the statement that Christians are required to make. So it sounds like Daniel is telling us that the Roman Empire of that time ended the 7 centuries of Roman-Persian wars by infiltrating the Persian religious beliefs and converting them to a new religion that was an offshoot of Roman Christianity. And verse 27 seems to confirm that. The direct translation says, "Two kings whose inner heart is evil, and they speak falsehood. They sit at one table," or they sit at the same table, "and prosper until the end, continuing until the appointed time." And then verse 28 in the King James says, "Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant." But notice that in the direct translation, it says his heart will be upon the Holy Covenant. So verse 28 can also say, "And he will return the land with great goods or much plunder, and his heart will be upon the Holy Covenant to make them turn back or return the land. And then verse 29 says, at the appointed time he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or the latter. So verse 29 is starting a new section. So verses 23 through 28 seem to perfectly describe what occurred with the rise of Islam ending the Roman-Persian conflict, what seems to have been a covert religious infiltration of Persia by the Roman Empire. So it says, after the league made with him, in other words, after the peace treaties signed during Justinian, he, the king of the south, the king of the north, the Roman Empire, will work deceitfully. For one shall rise up and shall become strong with a small people. He shall enter peaceably upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers, and he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south, that would be Arabia, with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. They that eat a portion of his meat shall destroy him, meaning they that eat with the Arabians will destroy them, and many shall fall down slain. Two kings whose inner heart is evil, they speak falsehood, they sit at the same table, and they will prosper until the end, continuing until the appointed time. So the appointed time in the end refers to the asteroid impact. We looked at that in the last video on Daniel 2, 7, and 8. So verse 27 seems to be saying this deception will continue until the end time. And he, the king of the north, the Roman Empire, will return the land with great goods, meaning will take some of the land that they had before and the goods. And his inner heart, the Roman Empire's inner heart, will be upon the Holy Covenant to make them return the land. Which could mean the purpose of the Holy Covenant is to take back the land. So the next section starts in verse 29, and the direct translation says, and at the appointed time or place or meeting, he will return and go into the south country. After the fallout of the chief, or the American Standard translation says, but this last time it will not turn out the way it did before. So it sounds like they had a change of leadership and the plan didn't go over well at first with the new leader. And this time it didn't turn out the way it did before. It says, for the ships of Kittim will come against him. So the word Kittim, which is number 3794, literally means Cyprus or islanders of the Mediterranean Sea. So it says the ships of Cyprus will come against him and he will turn back and be indignant or become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action and return. And this translation right here says show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. But notice this word that was translated as forsake is number 5800. And this is the King James translation in the Blue Letter Bible right here. It says, he shall return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. But notice the word 5800 has a second definition, and that is to restore or prepare. So this can also say, and he will take action and return and discern to restore the Holy Covenant or have intelligence with them to restore the Holy Covenant. So verse 29 is saying, at the meeting, the king of the north, which probably refers to either the Roman emperor or the pope of Rome, it says he will go to the south country, but this time it won't turn out the way it did before. This time the ships of Cyprus will come against him. So let's just look at that first. The ships of Cyprus, it says, will come against the king of the north, the Roman Empire. And remember, it also indicated this occurred after a change in leadership. So At Muhammad's death, the first Muslim caliphate was established, and the Rashidun caliphate lasted from 632 until 661. This is a map of it right here. And in 661, Muawiyah the first established the Umayyad dynasty of the caliphate and developed a navy in the Levant and used that to confront the Roman Empire. It says in 649, he constructed a fleet of ships and conquered Rhodes and later took Cyprus. And it says at the first raid, the people of Cyprus were obliged to pay an annual tribute to the Muslims. But in 654, they invaded again because Cyprus offered to help the Romans against them. And then in 655, it says the Muslim navy of 200 ships attacked the Roman navy and sank 500 of their ships. And this occurred during the reign of Roman Emperor Constans II. So verse 29 and 30 say, at the meeting, he, either Constans II or the Pope, will return and go into the south country, but this time it will not turn out the way it did before. The ships of Cyprus will come against him and he will be grieved, which makes sense because 500 of the Roman ships sank. And then it says, and he will turn back and be enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action and then have intelligence with them to restore the Holy Covenant. So at this point, it seems the Holy Covenant refers to the covert league between the religious leaders of the Christian and Muslim empires. And maybe that's why it's called the Holy Covenant or the Holy Treaty. It was a secret religious covenant that began when Justinian gave the popes political power. And then verse 31 after that says, forces will arise and pollute the sacred place of the fortress and turn aside or do away with the continuity or do away with the regular sacrifice and set up the abomination of desolation. So verse 31 is the event that Jesus warned about, the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel. So Jesus said it would be the event that will precede the tribulation period, and at the end of that, the asteroid will hit. So verse 31 says, and forces will stand with him, that's the king of the north, the Roman Empire at this point, and they will pollute the sacred place of the fortress and take away the daily sacrifice and set up the abomination of desolation. So around 684, 685, the construction of the Dome of the Rock began. And that was during the reign of Abd-al-Malik. But the interesting thing about the Dome of the Rock is, although most people think of it as a Muslim temple, it actually bears more resemblance to the Roman Empire's Christian temples. It says here, the octagonal plan of the structure may have been influenced by the Byzantine Chapel of St. Mary. So the Dome of the Rock was set up in the center of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, where the ancient temple that Jesus walked in was destroyed in 70 CE. It says at that time, the Romans placed a temple to Jupiter, and that during the Byzantine era, which we're in right, we're talking about right now, it says Jerusalem was primarily Christian. Well, that's interesting because that's when the Dome of the Rock was set up. Jerusalem was primarily Christian at that time. And then it says the construction of the Dome of the Rock was supposedly ordered by the Muslim caliph, but they built it not in the traditional Persian architecture, but according to the measurements of the Roman Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It says the diameter of the dome is 20 meters and its height is 20 meters. And the Roman church, its diameter is 20 meters and the height of it is 21 meters. It's the same, almost exactly the same. And also it says they each measure approximately 60 feet wide and 36 feet tall. So the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is said to be the place where Jesus died. And it says here, the Roman emperor in the second century built a temple dedicated to the Roman goddess Venus on that site. And the Roman emperor in 325 ordered that a church be built there. So the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was built 300 years before the Dome of the Rock. So some scholars have postulated that the architecture of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome was based on the Dome of the Rock, but the Romans were building structures like this long before the Dome of the Rock was built. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre right here was built around 325 CE, and the Dome of the Rock was built 300 years later, between 684 and 691. So this is Roman architecture, not Persian. The Dome of the Rock is a Roman temple sitting on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And also it says here, the Dome of the Rock was under construction during the conflict with Al-Zabar, and this led some historians, both medieval and modern, to suggest that the Dome of the Rock was built to rival the Kaaba. And the Kaaba was the ancient Persian temple. This is the more recent structure, but it was cube-shaped, completely different from the Roman architecture. The Dome of the Rock is a Roman temple. It's not a Persian temple. The Persian temple right here, the Kaaba, is more ancient than the religion of Islam. So remember, Muhammad's denunciation of the Meccan traditional religion was especially offensive to his own tribe because they were guardians of the Kaaba. So the Kaaba was not Muslim originally. It says here the Kaaba was the focal point of Meccan religious life that Muhammad threatened to overthrow. But in the present day, it's considered a Muslim shrine. And there is a black stone that is located on the eastern corner that, according to legend, was placed by Abraham. And remember, the black stone that was a significant part of the Temple of the Sun in 2nd century Syria, which was a Roman client kingdom at that time. And now the black stone is a significant part of the Muslim Kaaba in Mecca. But the Kaaba, again, is much older than the religion of Islam. It says here an idol was placed on the roof of the Kaaba 400 years before Muhammad. And an ancient Greek writer said, the genuine antiquity of the Kaaba ascends beyond the Christian era, a famous temple whose superior sanctity was revered by all the Arabians, and the silken veil was first offered by the Homerites, who reigned 700 years before the time of Muhammad. And then according to Encyclopedia Britannica, it says before the rise of Islam, it was revered as a sacred sanctuary. And according to the Quran, the Muslim holy book, the Kaaba was built by Abraham and his son Ishmael, where he placed a black stone that had fallen from heaven on a nearby hill. So it sounds like a meteorite. It says the black stone is believed to be the only remnant of the original structure made by Abraham. So this cube-shaped ancient Persian temple is very different from the domed Roman temples. So the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem is not Persian. It's a Roman temple. So Daniel 11 verses 29 and 30 seem to refer to a change in leadership that led to a misunderstanding, then the restoration of the religious covenant between the two empires. And then verse 31 refers to the setting up of the Dome of the Rock on the Jerusalem Temple Mount by the Roman Empire. And also, this occurred 10 kings after Justinian the First. So the fourth king after Justinian the Great was Phocas. The seventh was Heraclonus. And the tenth was Justinian the Second, who reigned when the Dome of the Rock was set up. And right after him was the 20 years of anarchy that started. So the 10 kings from Justinian the First, right here when the Holy Covenant started, 10 kings from him until the Dome of the Rock was set up during the reign of Justinian the Second. And just one final point. There was actually a man who came out in recent years who claimed he was formerly a Jesuit and a Catholic priest during the 50s. And he claims he was taught by the Vatican that Muhammad was manipulated by the Catholic Church to create Islam, and that Khadija, the woman who proposed to Muhammad, was actually a Catholic nun in an Arabian monastery who was told by a bishop to marry him and sow the seeds of what was to become Islam. And I just thought that was interesting because Pope Pelagius II, who was the Roman religious leader when Sergius the monk met Muhammad, this pope went a little overboard with the celibacy laws, according to Pope Gregory, who was right after him. It says, Pope Pelagius II labored to promote the celibacy of the clergy, and he issued such stringent regulations on this matter that his successor, Pope Gregory, thought them too strict and modified them. So it's interesting, he developed strong feelings about that issue during the time Muhammad was being groomed by a Christian monk, apparently, and supposedly proposed to by a Christian nun. So I'm not saying his claims are true, but Daniel 11 does seem to confirm at least part of what he claims was taught, that the Roman Catholic Church was responsible for the rise of Islam and the end of those Roman-Persian wars. So Daniel chapter 11, verses 1 through 31, seem to take place from the first Persian Empire until the Eastern Roman Empire and the setting up of the Abomination of Desolation, the Dome of the Rock on the Jerusalem Temple Mount. And that's all we're going to cover for today. We'll continue this in the next video. So to watch the whole series playlist, you can click on the link right here. And there are also several links below. Just click on Show More in the description box to open up more links. And I just want to say thank you so much to those of you that are making this research possible, because I cannot do this without the support of viewers like you. So thank you. I hope you're doing well, and I'll talk to you next week.